Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento is home to one of the largest Afghan refugee communities in the country. And 3 weeks since the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, dozens of students remain in the country under Taliban rule. This is in addition to the estimated thousands of Afghan refugee students California is expecting to welcome in the coming weeks. We're going to get an update on the status of students and their families stranded in Afghanistan, as school staff here work tirelessly to bring them back home safely. Kent Kern is the superintendent of San Juan Unified School District. Welcome, Kent.
Morning. Thanks for having us.
And Nate McGill is the principal at Ethel I. Baker Elementary School, which is within Sacramento City Unified School District. Welcome, Nate.
Morning. Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Superintendent Kern, at one point, just a few weeks ago, it was believed that San Juan Unified had the largest number of Afghan-American students displaced. I mean, approximately 27 students, and that's not including their families. Your district said that number potentially is higher right now?
That is, the latest numbers we had 41 students still in Afghanistan with over 70 family members. We did get one family safely out this weekend that had three students. So we're in the upper 30s and we're working every day to try and get those as many families out as we can as soon as possible.
I think going from 27 to 41 just shows how fluid of a situation this is.
Yeah, we actually had a lot of families that were afraid to even share the information with us. As we were working that first weekend, as the government was pulling out, we were working with staff from Congressman Barra's office to fill out all the paperwork for our families. So that weekend was kind of a full court press with staff trying to communicate with those families, get the documentation we needed, pictures of those folks, of the documentation. But families were hesitant because they didn't know who they could trust. And so over the course of the last couple of weeks, that's where we've identified more families as their students were over there.
Well, it's also promising to hear that the three students have returned safely back here to Sacramento. Without compromising their safety, of course, what can you tell us about the past 3 weeks and counting?
Well, it's been probably the most important work that we've ever done, I would say that. But we have staff who are from Afghanistan that are contacting the families as frequently as possible to get updates. In fact, two of the individuals that I'm working most closely with, one of them was in Afghanistan and got out the weekend before the last flights. And the other individual, his wife and kids were over there as well. So they know better than anybody what's going on over there. They've lived that experience. They supported the American government for a period of time. That's why they're here now. And they are communicating directly with those families. And that creates a really high level of trust when they are speaking directly with somebody who works in the school district, who is from Afghanistan, understands what they're going through. And so through our contacts, that's really creating the connection we need and allowing us to get the information that we need to hopefully bring these families back.
San Juan Unified is an exceptionally diverse student body. I was reading an EdSource article yesterday, and it mentioned that international students actually transfer to your school district sometimes because of just the resources offered. So can you just run us through the types of students and the demographics of students that you serve?
Yeah, we do have a very diverse population. I'll share with you, we currently have over 1,700 Afghan refugees in our district, and that number continues to enroll. Sacramento as a region has been one of the most welcoming areas in the country. So we've seen a real increase in our Dari, Pashto, our Arabic speakers. We have, you know, a large population from other nations as well, but focusing right now really on the number of Afghan refugees we have. And I was at a press conference recently with Congressman Barra as well, and the agencies that are bringing folks in and helping them settle in were saying that we saw the largest influx of refugees in the first part of August come in than we did in the previous number of months. So my guess is we in our district, Sac City, other districts are going to see more and more of these students enrolling in the next couple of weeks as they've gone through the process through the settlement agencies.
Nate, Ethel I. Baker within Sac City Unified is also incredibly diverse. And, you know, we had you on a couple weeks ago about the three students that are stranded in Afghanistan with their families. What update do you have on them?
Yeah, I wish I had something more substantial in terms of movement. There's a few things that I, you know, with specifics, I can't totally share just out of safety. Currently, the family and I and then, you know, by extension, the school district are working with a few third party operations. And there's a couple organizations who are trying to get in there and help that are not directly related to the U.S. government. And so the family is holding out hope that these organizations can get them across a border potentially to get a flight out. In the last few weeks since we spoke, we've been in contact with the State Department. The State Department has assigned a case manager to the family. To what extent the case manager is going to help, or how they'll be helping, that part is unclear. And unfortunately, the family has not heard from the case manager assigned. And again, I don't know how quickly these things work or exactly what the mechanics of it are from the State Department. But what I do know is that there is plenty of energy and or momentum with these third party operations, which I think are becoming more and more common to get folks out. And my family, they have green cards. And so as I understand it, they are a prioritized group.
You mentioned the last time we talked just how much of a blessing it is that they speak English, because that's not always a guarantee.
Yeah, and that sort of came up this week. We found another two families from Sac City Unified who are also in Afghanistan. And like we talked about before, as schools have been in session a few weeks, those absent students are coming up and then schools are doing their outreach. It just so happens that we did our outreach early. So we knew the situation, but so we have two more families. And again, it underscores this point that if you don't have the kind of linguistic resources, like San Juan was talking about at times, or those connections, those families can fall through the cracks. And so that's my bigger picture worry. How many other just Sacramento Afghan folks are stuck there?
Given that there's been some promising developments with a caseworker and some liaisons of that in that nature, has your level of concern waned or grown? Because I know that you are regularly communicating with them.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking just about every day. Already spoke this morning. The level of concern for them is much higher because and it's not so prevalent in the media, but to the extent that I can share on a morning radio show, I think that things are violent there. It is a matter of life or death right now. The text that I got over the weekend sort of outlined a pretty near and very serious threat to the family and other folks. And again, those who had historically either been sympathizers or helpers of the United States government or even the UN, those folks are in serious danger from just about in every place that they're at. So the parents are pretty concerned, and you know their specific story reached national news. So through AP News, and what the family told me this weekend was that they were even more concerned because that story then reached the news there. And so that's a scary connection for them. Obviously, everyone was confidential and identities weren't given, but they're pretty concerned.
Yeah. Superintendent Kern, I mean, the same question goes to you. Has your level of concern waned or grown?
It's grown 100%. You know, agree with Nathan that the situation over there is not great for these families. They supported the American government. I believe that the Taliban is searching for these folks, and they are in safe houses. And it really needs to be a coordinated effort by the government, because these families are in danger. We promised them when they were supporting our country that we would be there to help them. And, you know, one of the challenges we have is we actually have fractured families where some of the family members are here and other family members are there. And in some situations, it might be the father is here. So you have a mother with their children. And we know in Afghanistan that the women don't have a voice. And so there are just situations like that where it is imperative that we do everything we can as a school district, as individuals, We've been in contact with multiple senators, Senator Feinstein's office we're working with, as we mentioned, Congressman Barrett. We're doing everything we can to heighten the importance that it has to be a coordinated effort to get these folks back. Or as Nathan said, it's going to be these other organizations that are taking a much more dangerous approach to get these people to safety.
Right, because you're asking them to go to another country.
Yeah, and as Nathan said, we're in communication with people, understanding as much as we need to that they're going to do to get these people to safety. And we support that, because until we see a concerted effort from the government, any means necessary to get these folks home is really what we want to see happen.
I'm just curious, for the both of you, as not only educators, but with the perspective and experience of welcoming a diverse student body, I mean, did you ever imagine having this type of challenge in terms of being an educator? Nate, I'll start with you.
Well, year 18 in Sac City Unified, so I've seen plenty. And it is akin to, immigration is a thing that comes up every single year for our students. We have folks who have been seeking asylum, and that's a typical thing. You know, we stand with our undocumented families, and that in our neighborhood, there's a lot of them. So this is a little bit par for the course. This is certainly a new one, but again, like a superintendent said, these are our families. So it's obviously our responsibility, but it's frustrating in that as a school district, we're doing what we can, but we must depend on the U.S. government to do something. And that makes it really difficult. Otherwise, we're sort of throwing caution to the wind with third party folks. But yeah, there's no manual for this. We're just leaning on these relationships.
Hey, Superintendent Kern, you mentioned 1,700 of your students within your district are Afghan. Did you ever imagine having to work in this type of level, which is just frustrating and such a dire situation for your students?
No, and as Nathan said, there's no handbook for this. And I think one of the challenges for me that has tested my patience is we're in the middle of COVID and all the challenges we have to educate students. And right now, this is my biggest priority, is doing this work. And at times, some other things that people want to seem is really important. And I need to be sensitive to it because it is here. But this is a life and death situation we're dealing with. And so we're going to continue to do everything we can every day in communicating with the families, as Nathan said, with his family. It's going to take that type of support for these folks while they're there to bring them back home safely.
This developing situation, I mean, just listening to the both of you, it's chaotic, it's uncertain, it's grave. But I just want to end with, are there silver linings of optimism for the both of you? Nate?
I'll have to take a deep breath on that one. What's great is that it's still a story. It's still getting attention. We still have folks here who are pushing hard for it. What would be the worst, a nightmare situation, is that these are forgotten people, right? And anybody in education wouldn't let that happen. So in some regard, there is a silver lining. My entire teaching staff and support staff are pulling for them. But I have to say, Vicky, there's not much, because to date, I haven't seen a ton of outcomes with respect to getting this family out that I'm looking for. And so that makes it really hard, but not nowhere near as hard as it is for my family right now.
Superintendent Kern?
Yeah, I do see a little silver lining. I was on the phone quite a bit yesterday afternoon and into last night, where there were some flights being coordinated, where there was the possibility of a handful of our families getting on those. It looks right now like the prioritization, though, is with families who have members who have a U.S. passport. And so still those individuals that have just those LPRs, the legal permanent residents, the green cards, I don't know that the prioritization is there yet from the American government on those. And that's where it's like there's two layers of this. But those are individuals who served our country, just like the families who came over here and had a child since, and that's why they have an individual that's an American citizen. So I do see a little bit of hope, but there is urgency in this matter.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, because Superintendent Kern, you mentioned that you are reaching out to Congress members Matsui and Barra's office in our areas. What are you hearing from them?
Well, we have a really close relationship with some staff in Congressman Barra's office, and they're working through the process. We're sharing information back and forth, but it still seems like there's not the organized, coordinated effort at the national level that needs to take place to get these families home. And until that's prioritized by the president and our governments, I'm not sure we're going to see the efforts that we need to. And you're going to have people like Nathan and myself and my team doing whatever we can to bring these families home safely.
Principal McGill, I see you nodding along with Superintendent Kern.
100%. This situation comes from the top. We're talking about folks who have helped our government, like Superintendent Kern said, their constituents in our district, you know, regardless of their documentation status. And everyone bears a responsibility of getting them back. And that starts at the very top.
I just want to thank the both of you for spending time with us and providing an update. And I just wish your students the absolute best.
Vicky, thank you for having us and allowing us the time to bring this, because we need to keep this. I appreciated the way Nathan said we cannot have this be a forgotten group of folks. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Vicky. And thanks, Superintendent Kern. Absolutely. Okay.
Kent Kern is the superintendent of San Juan Unified School District, and Nate McGill is the principal of Ethel I. Baker Elementary School within Sac City Unified. Up next, we dive into two investigations from NPR's California News Hub, highlighting problematic issues surrounding wildfires. One involves why some Cal Fire firefighters are getting sick and dying during training exercises. And two, the second, is a recent wave of lawyers rushing to represent fire victims has some sounding the alarm of broken promises and exploiting tragedy. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A reality when firefighters are on the front lines battling wildfires, accidents happen. Whether it's minor burns or more severe injuries, the risk is always present in wildfire fights. But one hazard that firefighters face isn't out of the middle of a firefight. It's actually during training exercises, and that's heat-related illnesses. And when breaking down the data about heat illnesses experienced by Cal Fire employees, the majority happen to part-time and inmate firefighters. Joining us now with their investigation into injuries and deaths of Cal Fire firefighters are Jacob Margolis and Brian Edwards. Jacob is a science reporter for KPCC, the NPR member station based in Los Angeles. Jacob, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian is a Columbia Journalism Fellow. Welcome to Insight, Brian.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, Jacob, I get just starting off. What prompted this dive?
Yeah, you know, we had taken back in July or June even, we started to dive into the impact of heat on workers throughout California. And we put out another investigation that looked at the heat standard in California, as we're one of the few states that has one that's meant to protect workers. As we started to dig into the data, we noticed there were some heat issues with firefighters, and especially seasonal firefighters. And we saw that people kept getting sick, and we came across a couple deaths, and we're pretty alarmed.
What temperatures are we talking about when it comes to heat-related illnesses?
I mean, everything from 70 degrees upwards, I would say. People don't realize that you can suffer from heat illness in the 70s, but, you know, it is very possible. And we've seen that with farm workers. We've seen that with firefighters as well.
Brian, you identify three reasons why Cal Fire firefighters keep getting sick due to heat. Can you just lay them out for us briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, we'd really sought out to figure out why these firefighters were getting sick. And we came across really three big things that we had seen. And one is that, you know, as these seasonal and incarcerated firefighters are coming back for the season, there's either a lack of an implementation or kind of a lack of a uniform training plan to get them back into shape, to firefighting shape, as we were calling it. Another thing that we had seen is that, you know, heat can can trigger different health conditions, underlying conditions that might occur, especially related to the heart. And so we saw a lot of heart issues that people were having and dug into the process and saw that the pre-screening for these types of issues is pretty minimal. And, you know, there are more extensive tests, but those are voluntary for a lot of firefighters. And the third thing that we had found was, you know, easing these firefighters into the heat, especially when they're at kind of these rehire training academies, is really something that's handled station to station. And that can often, you know, if somebody's coming from, you know, being used to 70 degrees and they're working in 90 degrees, that can be really impactful. And kind of wrapped around all of these was a larger cultural issue, kind of with this, you know, pushing on and trying to improve even when firefighters were feeling the heat.
I mean, I think further compounding the issues and the challenges that you just laid out, and the risks for that matter, is the fact that maybe part-time employees are more susceptible to heat-related illnesses as opposed to a full-time firefighter.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, these full-time firefighters, part of the job for any firefighter is when they are on, is they are training, they are working out, much like these instances we were looking into. Part-time and incarcerated firefighters, they're taking the winter off. So when they come back, you know, they're especially at risk during those early days to be afflicted by heat.
Jacob, you looked at CAL FIRE workplace injury logs from, I think, January of 2020 to just last month, August 3rd. What did you find?
Yeah, what we found was that over the year and a half period, 43 firefighters suffered from heat-related illness during that time. Now, we did have records. They were less comprehensive records, so we would love those records going back to the early 2000s, but we have less comprehensive records going back that far, and we found that at least, from what we know, five firefighters did pass away from what appear to be heat-related issues during that time. And there was one very clear case, one very alarming case in San Diego, which was the case of Yaroslav Katkov, who passed away after a training hike.
Yeah, reading about just the report detailing his final moments is just excruciating. And you were actually able to talk to his girlfriend following his death, correct?
Yeah, Ashley Valerio, his longtime partner, and you know, she really laid out for us how disappointed she was in CAL FIRE as an organization, how she felt misled at times, and she was very generous with our time to, you know, help us learn who Yaroslav was, and he seemed like a very nice and caring person.
You're supposed to like have faith that those people would like keep him safe. Definitely, it shows what kind of leadership that they're willing to allow.
What was she told about the circumstances surrounding his death?
Yeah, you know, she was told that everything was done that could have been done to stop him from going down this, you know, from cascading to the point where he had to be airlifted out, that he was treated pretty much right away. And what we found was that there some gaps there, and that when the, you know, reading through the investigative report, it's quite alarming because, and this is supported by both Cal OSHA and CAL FIRE documents, what you see is that, so to lay it out for the audience, he went on a hike with a couple other people first thing in the morning. He was struggling on that hike. He was struggling, and they're wearing an awful lot of gear. And it's quite a steep hike because it's good to train in steep terrain, because that's what you find often in California, especially with fires. But he was struggling, and he was showing signs of heat illness during that first hike, including at one point, it's noted that he kind of started to walk out into traffic. He appeared disoriented. And at that point, it seems that his captain should have pulled the plug on it, and they should have wrapped it up. But he didn't do it fast enough, according to the captain. So they went to go ahead and do it again. And, you know, from what you could see in the documents, you know, Katkov wasn't going to give up, and it was up to his captain to really protect him. And, you know, it got to the point where he was so far gone, eventually he ended up passing from hyperthermia. And it's really sad. He was only 28.
Wow. I mean, you read through an enormous amount of documents and reports from Cal OSHA, including Cal OSHA. Did you actually talk to Cal Fire? Did they give an interview? Did they give any context behind these numbers or the information that you found?
We had some discussions, but they never really offered up we would have sat down with them and walked through basically the whole thing and had a deep discussion with Tom Porter or anybody else there, like the head of safety. That was never really offered up, and we gave repeated chances over the course of several months. So it's not like this is a surprise to them.
Hmm. Brian, I think a lot of people are probably thinking, myself included, I mean, I think the general consensus is that heat-related illnesses and even in its worst case, death is preventable. So why is this happening with firefighters within CAL FIRE?
Yeah, and you're right. We talked to several experts, and deaths are considered by most experts 100% preventable. So a case like Yaroslav Kakov certainly just should not be happening. And many of these injuries, especially I think the ones that we highlighted also, you know, have instances of leadership or supervisors, you know, not pulling back in these moments. And I think that is the key in what we heard from a lot of people, including, you know, CAL FIRE insiders themselves or firefighters, is that, you know, like Jacob had mentioned about Katkoff, he and many other firefighters, you know, they you know, are very proud of their work, and they want to push on and do the best that they can. And so it really is up to educating a lot of these supervisors and the people that are in charge to watch for these signs, identify them, which everybody in the state is supposed to be doing because of the heat standard, but also knowing when to pull the plug. And until, I think, you know, a lot of those issues that we highlighted with cultural things and kind of this macho culture of pushing on, you know, is reeled back in, these issues are going to continue to take place.
And, you know, CAL FIRE, they said they vehemently disagreed with our characterization and email we sent to them, which was that there was a punitive culture of pushing on at all costs. And while I think we feel that overall, I don't think anybody wishes that kind of thing would happen, you know, we heard of an instance from CAL FIRE Union just a couple of months ago where there was a supervisor down in San Diego that had to be talked to by the union, who was pushing new seasonal firefighters when they weren't feeling well. There wasn't a formal reprimand, and it seemed to be handled pretty quickly. But given the size of CAL FIRE, you can imagine, and we have other cases that we lay out in the piece, you can imagine that stuff like that continues to happen.
I think that's an important part that Jacob hit on, is that, you know, we continually were looking to see, you know, is this not just a pattern, but still happening? And, you know, we continued to find, you know, recent cases of this occurring.
Jacob and Brian, thanks for spending time with us and sharing your investigation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that is Jacob Margolis and Brian Edwards. Jacob is a science reporter for KPCC, the NPR member station based in Los Angeles. Brian is a Columbia Journalism Fellow, and they are discussing their investigation into heat-related injuries and death surrounding CAL FIRE training exercises. You can read their entire investigation at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. After a massive wildfire destroys homes, many are left vulnerable as they figure out how to rebuild the homes that they created. In the aftermath, the number of lawyers, some coming from as far as Texas, arrive in wildfire-devastated areas, reaching out to victims in the hopes of representing them in litigation against PG&E. But past experiences have made some wary of trusting the lawyers and their promise of a settlement. Campfire survivors are still waiting for their settlements 3 years later, some still living in trailers on the leveled plots of land where their homes once stood. The Plumas County District Attorney has gone as far as distributing pamphlets to let residents know to be careful as they search for a lawyer. Here to bring us her reporting on the recent wave of lawyers rushing to represent fire victims is KQED's California Report co-host, Lily Jamali. Lily, welcome back to Insight.
Great to be back with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Lily, you have closely followed the bankruptcy surrounding PG&E, and you've heard from fire victims in the past years through your reporting. What are some of the trends you continue to see as more wildfires break out?
Yeah, well, there is now this grim fire season tradition of these fires ravaging communities. And then usually within a couple of weeks, we see lawyers descend on these towns to try to recruit their next batch of clients. And this year, we've seen all kinds of gimmicks, from, you know, free gas giveaways to free barbecue. And oh, by the way, there's a stack of legal contracts sitting there next to the brisket, kind of thing. These attorneys set up offices in places where these fires have hit, oftentimes in pretty short order. And one firm is even offering FaceTime with Erin Brockovich, who made her name fighting PG&E, but is now a paid spokesperson for one attorney group that includes the lawyer Doug Boxer, son of former Senator Barbara Boxer. So, you know, what we're seeing right now is PG&E fire victims from the past, many of whom are still suffering right now, some of them as many as 6 years later, organizing themselves to reach out to this new group of fire survivors. Most of them are in Plumas County, and they're using social media. They're using their networks of friends and family. And, you know, these are folks who really understand what it is like to experience the trauma of losing your home, of losing your town. And their message is buyer beware, that there's no rush. Take the time to process what's just happened to you and don't feel pressured into signing up with a lawyer right away.
I mean, just hearing you talk about barbecues for individuals who've been evacuated during a wildfire, I mean, is this well-intentioned or is this just kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, exploiting trauma and pain for people that are displaced?
Well, you know, I think these attorneys see an opportunity, and I don't mean to paint all of them with one broad brush. There is a lot of variation, but I do think that these attorneys see PG&E as a target. And it is a company that they think, you know, a lot of them think will always get a state bailout if it comes down to that. And so I think the opportunity to many of them is just too good to pass up.
You spoke with one, I believe his name is Brett Cook. Can you explain that interaction you had with him?
Yeah, this was actually our colleague over at KUNR in Reno. Brett Cook is an attorney based in the town of Greenville, which recently burned in the Dixie Fire, largest fire of the year. It's already burned almost 1 million acres. And Brett Cook is a local attorney who has partnered with this attorney group in San Diego called Potter Handy. Now, Potter Handy has come under scrutiny for allegedly engaging in what are known as, you know, I think it's called serial litigation. So they are using the American Disabilities Act to sue small businesses in San Francisco is the allegation. And they have ended up in Greenville. They were in Plumas County recently, and Paul Boger spoke to Brett Cook. I think we have a cut from him.
We do.
Which we can play. Let's go ahead and listen to that.
We're just providing some food for the people that were evacuated from the Dixie Fire. This is a way of giving back to the community, and it was simply a way to, you know, to make people put a little smile on their face.
I mean, going back in July, PG&E did indicate that its equipment may have started the Dixie Fire, but this is still being investigated. Is this premature, or is this just like jumping while the iron is hot?
Well, I think that there is absolutely reason to believe that PG&E may have been involved precisely because of that incident report that they filed just a couple of days after the Dixie Fire began. So, you know, essentially, I think the thinking here is there is an opportunity here. And what we oftentimes see with these attorneys is they want to get in quickly and they want to amass as many clients as they can. So by getting there first, the odds are better that they're going to amass a larger group. You know, if you talk to people on the back end of this, people who were involved in the most recent PG&E settlement with fire survivors, many of them will say they're not really that thrilled to be part of a group of thousands and thousands of people. Some of them don't think they're getting a whole lot of personal attention. They're concerned that their claims have really been held up. And so it's kind of a mixed bag. You might get more power in, you know, when you're part of a large group, but you also on the receiving end, when you're having your individual claim looked at, might not have as much attention given to your case.
You know, we also have a clip from the Plumas County District Attorney. I mean, you know, he's even getting involved trying to inform residents and just kind of alerting them of the potential that, you know, maybe their best interests aren't being taken by some attorneys.
This is a big life-changing decision that you're going to make. So we want you to take a step back, take a deep breath, get all the information you can, and then make a really good choice that's going to protect yourself going forward.
We jumped the gun a little bit, but go ahead, Lily. What were you saying?
David Hollister, the Plumas County DA, you know, is one of the many people who has watched these lawyers descend on his community. And the things he says to watch out for are lawyers who are soliciting clients who might not be able to exercise what's known as reasonable judgment because of their emotional or mental state at the time. Lawyers who are promising a particular outcome. And so he has been distributing materials in conjunction with the state bar, basically saying exactly what he just said, encouraging people to take their time, both with hiring a lawyer as well as with hiring contractors.
I mean, this has really been your wheelhouse for years. I mean, there are currently tens of thousands of survivors of wildfires sparked by PG&E equipment who were promised billions of dollars, you know, $13.5 billion. And we had you on earlier this year to talk about the probe into the Fire Victim Trust and your investigation that brought this on. Can you give us an update on that?
Yes, unfortunately, you know, things are still moving very slowly. We still have only seen about $750 million distributed to fire victims. So there's 70,000 of them. A small slice of them have had their claims processed so far. And, you know, the real concern is the way that this settlement between PG&E, brokered by these attorneys, many of whom are trying to recruit right now, the way that that deal was structured, it includes a giant mound of PG&E stock. These fire survivors, through their trust, now hold almost a quarter of the company's shares. And so, you know, we're sort of confronted with this situation where the trust doesn't want to run out of money. They only have so much cash. And there's no doubt the trustee who's in charge of distributing this money has made it very clear they don't have enough for everybody, that these victims are never going to be made whole. And so if you're one of the lucky few who has had your case looked at and processed, you're only getting 30%. What's concerning to many fire survivors who are mobilizing right now is people like attorney Michael Watts, who is based in Texas, going around and saying that he helped broker a $13.5 billion settlement. It's not worth that. It's never been worth that. And that has a lot to do with the stock component. The amount on paper fluctuates constantly. And the trustee recently said that the trust is worth $10.5 billion right now, far short of what was promised. We have another infusion of a couple hundred million dollars of cash coming soon. But this has not gone well, by and large, for fire victims from 2015 to 2018.
Lily, thanks for catching us up on your reporting.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicki.
And that is KQED's California Report co-host Lily Jamali. Still ahead, Capitol Stage kicks off its new season highlighting the true story of one Japanese American taking on the U.S. government, defying internment during World War II. We meet the actor behind the one-man show and the timeliness of this story more than 70 years later. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Capitol Stage is rounding out its first performance of the season, a season like so many others that just takes on a deeper meaning after arts and culture was largely derailed over the past year and a half. Hold These Truths is a powerful, true story of one Japanese American's fight against the U.S. government, defying mass incarceration, also referred to as internment, during World War II. A defiance leading to a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the story is more than just a history lesson, resonating with social justice and denouncing AAPI hate crimes taking place today. Hold These Truths runs through the end of the week with showtimes beginning Wednesday. There's also an option to purchase a virtual ticket and watch it on demand. The one-man show is performed by actor Jamar Tagetak. Jamar joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thank you. We're also joined by the director of Hold These Truths, Jeffrey Lowe. Jeffrey, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Jamar, you have an expansive career as an actor. I was doing a little background on you. I mean, just after the year and a half that artists endured during this pandemic, does this role in Hold These Truths take on a deeper significance?
Absolutely. You know, we've been, you know, for the past 15 months, 18 months, we've been, you know, sheltering in place for, you know, for the longest time. And, you know, I was, you know, to be honest, I was worried. I was scared. I was nervous. What was going to happen to the theater? Were we going to be able to come back? And if we were going to come back, what was it going to look like? You know, and so there was a lot of fear behind it. And, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, added, you know, pressure, I guess, is what I can say, to do this piece as one of the first pieces coming back to the stages. You know, for me, it's a first because it's my first one-man show, and because of the content, because of the story behind Gorn Hirabayashi, there is, you know, pressure to really portray this historical figure in the best way possible. But it's less about pressure, and it's more about meaning, about meeting the moment. This is a time where theater goers are able to come back, and they are coming back, and they want to experience live theater again. And I want to experience being able to tell the story live in person. I mean, I love the idea that we have a, you know, a streaming show that people can watch if they're not comfortable coming to the theater yet. And that's great, and that's fantastic. And it's great that the theater can give many different options to patrons. But nothing can really beat the energy of live theater.
This is a one-man show. It's on your creative shoulders. You know, I'm just curious, what drew you to Gorn Hirabayashi?
You know, I think, you know, speaking with, you know, a few weeks before rehearsal started, you know, talking with Jeffrey, talking about this piece, you know, this piece is really, you know, our response to the rising violence committed against, you know, the AAPI community. And, you know, it's a really, what drew me to this piece is the challenge of being able to tell this story, being able to portray different characters in Gorn's story. But actually, the thing that drew me the most was he was just one person who said no to the government. And just the act of doing that, understanding that this was wrong, that he knew, you know, he was really a true American, you know, in a lot of ways. And it just, you know, brings up the idea, like, being an American has nothing really to do with your skin color or with, you know, where you came from. It's the idea of freedom, the idea of equality.
Well, a friend of mine watched your performance, as well as Chris, our audio engineer, and they were just blown away by your performance. I want to play a clip from Hold These Truths.
Deru kugi wa utareru. Dad first said it to me. The nail that sticks out is the one that gets hit. It's an old Japanese proverb. To stay out of danger or harm's way, one must conform, one must obey, one must be inconspicuous. We heard this growing up on the farm during the Great Depression. Hoovervilles, hobos, jobless men in railways, women and children in breadlines, and Washington State, still a Western frontier. It's settlers, hostile to newcomers. Newcomers, that is, like us.
Yeah, Jeffrey, I want to bring you in now. Ultimately, what do you want the audience to take away? I mean, it's just so powerful.
Yeah, you know, Jomar alluded to this, but you know, when we had the way that we were used to creating our art and performing our art taken away from us for so long, I personally wanted to make sure that I didn't take doing this work for granted. And it made me realize in that long time of sheltering in place and self-reflection that being able to do this work and do it for a living and do it in front of audiences is a real privilege. So for me, I'm really honored to tell this story and really honored to be able to uplift the journey and the triumph that Gorn experienced. And for me and with audiences, you know, I was talking to Jomar about this, and whenever you do a solo show and they're essentially talking to the audience pretty much the whole time, you kind of have to really answer the question at the beginning of rehearsals, who are you talking to? Who are you actually talking to? And for Jomar and I, we chatted about this, and in a lot of ways I wasn't necessarily interested in this being wholly just a history lesson. Because one, if you don't know the story, or you don't know that this happened to the Japanese Americans, like, you could go to a history book, you should read a textbook. And for me, the people that I was most interested in was thinking about all of the amazing contemporary people who are the contemporary Gordons, the modern day activists, the people who were the Black Lives Matter freedom fighters, the people fighting for voter rights, the Stacey Abrams, like any number of folks who are fighting for the same things that Gordon would have been fighting for if he were still alive today. I was thinking about those people, and Jomar and I were talking about, you know, we've heard so many of the people in our lives that are in those circles that do fight those fights. And so many of them, for very good reasons and for right reasons, are just saying they're so tired. And for me, I was saying, well, maybe this is who Gordon's talking to. Maybe Gordon is talking to the modern day versions of himself, and he's sharing with them a story where it was hard, it took a long time, but he stood up for what he believed in and didn't waver, and it did work out for him, and he did triumph. So for me, that's what I hope audiences see, is that, you know, that this can work and this does work. Mm-hmm.
And just going alongside the fact that, you know, this is looking back at a dark time in U.S. history several decades ago, but there are obviously lessons and stories that can be applied today. So we're going to play another clip, which really, I think a lot of people will resonate with a lot of people today.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. Do we in fact believe in the existence of self-evident truth, which by the very rightness of its being needs no human justification? And if we say such truths exist, how will they appear to us? In fragments or in full, over seconds or over centuries? And when they are made known to us, how fully will we see them? Will our vision of them be dimmed by the darkness of human corruption?
I want to end with asking the both of you just how poignant and powerful those clips are. I mean, the show is wrapping this week. Prior to that, it was performed in San Francisco. What moments of feedback still stick with you? Jamar?
When, you know, sometimes, you know, because of our, you know, COVID protocols and things like that, there are times where, you know, I'm not able to sort of interact or mingle with the patrons after the show. So we're usually kept separate, but sometimes they'll stick around and stay outside. And, you know, I gotta leave, you know, I have to go home. And, you know, the biggest one was, you know, people who have lived through the internments, and they just say, thank you. And they just say, thank you for, like, telling this story. And it's a very simple sort of, like, it isn't about me. It isn't about the performance. It's just thank you for telling the story. That's the thing that sticks out to me.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, I sort of had my initial impulse was to have a similar answer to that. There's a performer that both Jomar and I know named Randy Nakano, who is generally, you know, if he's listening to this, he's generally an intense guy, but his thank yous were particularly intense after our first performance, and it was extremely moving. But I will say that, you know, I think that there was some feedback that we've received where people were sort of inspired to keep moving forward. And to give them this gave them some energy. And I think it was a combination of both the story, the triumph, the character of Gordon. I think that one of the things that Jomar and I worked really hard at is, like, you know, Gordon, by all accounts, a playwright, Jeannie Sakata, had the chance to meet with him and go on hikes with him and do all these things. And Gordon, by all accounts, was just a joyful, joyful person. And so there's a lot of joy in the play, and there's a lot of joy in the stories and the way he tells them. And I think it was a combination of Gordon the person, Gordon's story, the triumph, and also just the energy you get again from being live and in person with someone telling you a beautiful story. But I was really moved to hear that this sort of lifted people up and gave them energy in a way that maybe we've missed for a long, long time.
Jamar and Jeffrey, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's fun.
Thank you.
I'm glad it was fun. And that is actor Jamar Tagatuk and director Jeffrey Lowe. Hold These Truths runs through the end of the week with showtimes beginning Wednesday at Capitol Stage in Sacramento. There's also the option to purchase a virtual ticket and watch it on demand. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.